From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is Eddie Shapiro, no relation. Eddie Shapiro is a theater journalist whose work has appeared in Out magazine, Instinct, and Backstage West. He is the co-author of Queens in the Kingdom, the ultimate gay and lesbian guide to the Disney theme parks, and the co-author of The Actor's Encyclopedia of Casting. His latest book is a collection of interviews with some of Broadway's great leading ladies, and it's called Nothing Like a Dame, Conversations with Great Women of Musical Theater. Eddie Shapiro, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. It's delightful to be here.
You know, I enjoyed your book very much, and Kristen Chenoweth, I thought, raised an interesting little point that I wanted to start with. She said something like, I don't care what everybody on the internet says. And it suddenly made me think, it made me think about how different it would be for a Broadway star now than, say, in Ethel Merman's day. That is, Ethel Merman only had to contend with the New York press, and Kristen Chenoweth has to contend with the entire world.
Well, yes, and on top of that, Ethel Merman only had to deal with a press that was pretty much writing. There were manners involved in theatrical journalism, not just reviews, but you know, even Walter Winchell's gossip column. Or that there was still a level of respect and decorum that just doesn't exist anymore. And now, of course, we're not just talking about journalists writing; we're talking about anybody who has fingers types crap into chat boards or whatever. And yes, there's a lot to contend with. So it is a completely different world in so many ways. That is, of course, one of them. But there are so many ways that the theater is just a completely, completely different animal now.
I was also thinking that, say, you know, Idina Menzel, her more people have seen her or heard her in Frozen than will ever conceivably see her live on the stage.
That is true. That is certainly true. But it's a very funny thing, because at the same time, when you talk about people like Ethel Merman or Carol Channing, when they were at their heyday, or in their heyday, the entire country knew who the great stars of Broadway were, because the music, pop music, was Broadway music. I mean, Hello Dolly was the number one album on the Billboard 100, and it was unseated by the Beatles, but it was the number one album. So everybody across the country knew who Carol Channing was. You can't say that's true anymore about anybody who's on Broadway, even Idina Menzel. So I think there's a level of fame that existed, even though Broadway was much more insular, that doesn't exist now because music tastes have changed so much.
Yeah, the American Popular Songbook was filled with songs from Broadway, even before Oklahoma. But I guess Oklahoma was the first cast album to permeate the society and bring
yes.
those songs into everybody's homes, and not just the songs, but the performers from the show doing them. And
yes.
I don't think cast albums sell particularly well. They're souvenirs now of people who've seen the show, mostly.
Yes, although they serve another really important purpose now, which is that for every show wants a cast album, because producers make their money back in licensing to regional theaters and summer camps and colleges and all that stuff. And the way a show gets a reputation, the way somebody decides they want to do it, is that they have the opportunity to listen to the music. So everybody ends up doing a cast album, which is great if you're a nutbag collector like myself who has to have everything. Because I grew up, I mean, this listening to cast albums and poring over the liner notes. And this book, the genesis of this book, and my love for Broadway for that matter, really started with falling in love with some of these women long before I ever saw them live. It was taking out records from the library and listening to these performances.
Well, what was the first show you saw on Broadway?
It was Inauspicious. The very first Broadway musical I saw was The Magic Show, which was by Stephen Schwartz, who, of course, had already written Godspell and went on to write Pippin and Wicked, of course, among others. But it was a vehicle for Doug Henning. I was 5 years old, and that was my first Broadway musical. But that same year, I saw St. Joan starring Lynn Redgrave, so I was...
Oh,
I had diverse tastes even then.
So you could just pretend that was your first show if you want.
Yes.
Well, I haven't seen that many Broadway shows over the years. I've seen a few because I live in California. But my first was Angela Lansbury in Mame.
Wow. That is an auspicious debut show to begin with. What do you remember about it?
Well, the interesting thing is that Angela Lansbury, and this is people who only know Angela Lansbury nowadays would be shocked, is that she was really sexy.
Yeah.
You know, people don't think of that, but she was totally sexy, and that was the thing that was like my focus, so to speak.
Well, I think that, you know, the picture on the cover of the book of her actually conveys that, and you see sort of how live and glamorous she was.
Yeah, she cut off all her hair. That was kind of a new thing then, to have really short hair like she had.
Well, and as you probably remember from reading her chapter, she cut off all of her hair during the rehearsal process, because that character, Mame, had something like 17 costume changes, and it was getting insane for her, and she just decided, you know what, let's simplify. I'm just going to cut off all the hair. So she did it sort of, you know, almost in desperation, but it worked.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, it was an amazingly great show. Interesting thing that I noticed in your interview with Angela Lansbury, and I wondered, Eddie Shapiro, how much editing did you do? Because at one point she says to you, oh, I'd love to get into that, but I have to take my nap soon. And I thought, you know, he could have cut that line, but you did, what, you know, so did you like not do any editing or what?
No.
Yeah.
I did a ton of editing. But the reason I left in sentences like that one is because the goal of the book was for the reader to feel like they're a fly on the wall listening to a conversation. So things that sort of made it feel more in the moment or more conversational, more casual, I left in, both for flavor, if you will, and also so that you would get a sense of the woman and not just of her information. However, some of these conversations, I sat with Patti LuPone for 10 and a half hours. So, yeah, there was editing involved.
Right, because that would be the whole book, wouldn't it?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Well, on the other hand, I think there's one or two places where somebody says, you know, leave the name out. But then there's somebody, and now you'll remember better than me, but somebody says Topol was a jerk. I mean, they just came right out and said the guy's name and that they hated him.
Yes.
And they didn't feel, did they know you were going to print that when they said it?
Yeah, although very occasionally, when I thought that somebody was saying something that would potentially get them into hot water, I would subsequently ask. So Patti LuPone is actually a good example of somebody who I sent passages from her chapter to, who, and I said, do you really want these things in print? Because they seem a little hot. And she said, yeah, go ahead and remove those two, but you can keep that one. Judy Kay was another one who I sent some stuff and said, you know, you really want this in there? And she said, sure, why not? But I gave them the out if I thought it was going to be inflammatory.
Most of your subjects are still working. So, I mean, anybody who is still working probably doesn't want to say bad things about people, because then they would say, well, I don't want to work with her because she'll just say bad things about me the next time Eddie Shapiro comes for tea.
I'm not sure. I mean, and I think that's some of the glory of the book. These women were so incredibly candid about so much. And some of them did not hold back on, as you say, on naming names. And, you know, people, Patti LuPone is a good example. She names a co-star who she called a travesty. And that person is young and working, and, you know, and I think Patti LuPone doesn't especially care. because that's how she felt about it. There are others who are more delicate. You know, there are 20 women in this book, and each of them, one of the things that I found very interesting is each of them, they got to the finish line, right? They're all absolutely at the top of their game. They are stars of the musical theater. But how they all got there is very different from one another, and how they each handle or maneuver being there is very, very different. So while someone like Patti might be, you know, very, very casual and willing to say things, she doesn't especially care if her opinions are known, there are others who are much more politically oriented and do. I don't think either is right or wrong. It's just a difference in the way of handling being in that role.
We're talking with Eddie Shapiro, and his new book is called Nothing Like a Dame, Conversations with the Great Women of Musical Theater. I wanted to ask you about why you chose to speak just with women. Well, you know, there's occasionally these plays have men in them also, but you focus just on the gals. Why is that?
I think that, there are a few answers to that. One is, while I do love The Men of Musical Theater just as much, knowing that this book was going to be long-form chapters, there was only so much space, so I decided for this volume anyway to focus exclusively on the women, although I'm doing the men next. But I think that in musical theater, it really is more of a female medium. The roles, the songs that we remember most, they're really primarily, not exclusively, but primarily written for the women. And the great roles that you think of, Mama Rose and Dolly and Mame and Cassie in A Chorus Line and Effie in Dreamgirls, those are the great, great female roles. And it's hard, other than, you know, say The King and The King and I or The Music Man, to come up with analogous great, great male roles. I think it's just more of a woman's medium.
I was really shocked or surprised, pleasantly surprised, I guess, at how uncatty these women are when they talk about each other. Almost all of them mention a different one of your subjects as, I love her, she's my mentor, she's my second mom. They just really are very supportive with each other.
Yeah, there's an absolute sisterhood there. And it's amazing, you know, for some of the events around the book when it launched, having several of them in a room together and watching the absolute love fest. And even though sometimes they are competitors of one another, either for awards or even for roles, they are still, they recognize, you know, the shared experiences that they all have. And some of them they've been each other's inspirations. They've certainly been each other's colleagues and peers. They work together in shows, and they go back. There's, as I said, a sisterhood, and it is really sort of nice to witness.
There was that moment that you refer to in the book at one point at the Sondheim's birthday celebration, and there's like four or five of these women, Elaine Strick and Patti LuPone, and Bernadette Peters was there, and they were all sitting there on stage together taking their turn. And I was thinking, that must have been uncomfortable for the ones who weren't singing to have to sit there and listen to the other one.
it's funny, you know, I asked both Patti LuPone and Audra McDonald about that. I may have even asked Donna Murphy about it, because she was one of those women as well. And, Patti LuPone said it was awful, sort of sitting like that, and all you could see was the other one's back, and, you know, whatever. And Audra McDonald said it was wonderful, because you felt like you were, you know, inches away from watching a master at their work. Different perspectives, same scenario.
Yeah, that's kind of a nice thing that you get when you have this collection of these women's interviews, different perspectives on sometimes the same show, same era, or doing a show that the other one had done earlier, things like that.
Or the same person. I mean, one of the things that I really enjoy a lot about this book, of course, each interview stands on its own. It's that woman's story. But then, as part of the whole, those 20 stories form sort of a tapestry that shows what it is to be a woman in the last half of the 20th century, or even now into the 21st. Many of them will talk about working with Stephen Sondheim or with Bob Fosse, and hearing the different experiences that they've each had, or sometimes similar experiences. It creates a fuller picture of some of these great masters, and I like that it sort of played out that way.
It does seem like Bernadette Peters is missing. Where did you try to get her and she wouldn't do it, or what?
Certainly I tried to get her, I tried very, very, very hard and very doggedly, and she actually agreed to do it, and then at the last minute pulled out, mostly because, just for her, talking about her career and reflecting on it is not especially her thing. So she opted out, and I was very sad about that, because she is really the egregious omission.
Yeah, because you've got all of her contemporaries, and I mean, she's such an important figure in American musical theater.
Yes, yes. I'm sad that she's that her voice isn't in here, but obviously, I try. I sort of feel like, you know, the other women are in here, certainly no slouch or slouches. They're not slouches, and even without her, I think the story gets told.
Absolutely, and it's a great story, and they all tell it well. What do you think you learned? I mean, what do you think of all the? I mean, you learned a lot, but what are the things, you know, stick out? Like, wow, that was phenomenal.
Yeah, there were a few things that every single chapter, and I know this kind of sounds gratuitous, but every single chapter, I learned something that surprised me or something new. But I think that the thing that overall surprised me the most was the level of insecurity that they all have. And I guess that surprised me because I sort of always figure, for me to feel insecure, that's totally appropriate. But you're at the top of the game. You're Audra McDonald. You have 5 Tony Awards. How could you possibly feel insecure? You're a proven entity, and the world loves you. You've never gotten a better view, except for Audra McDonald will tell you that she still, you know, has that thing where she wakes up and wonders if today's the day everybody's going to realize that she's a fraud. To some degree, every single one of these women expresses some level of insecurity that matches that, and that came as a total surprise to me.
Even stage fright.
Yes. Yeah, stage fright was fine. And also, another thing that was common that was just a surprise was the number of women who talked about being very happy to have won a Tony Award, but then pretty much not having the phone ring after having won the Tony Award. Just not to make any sense, but that was their experience.
Everybody had something interesting to say about the Tony Awards, but...
Yes, and every single one of these women is, in fact, a Tony Award winner. That was part of the criteria for being in the book.
Uh-huh.
So everybody has at least one. And I think some of that criteria, and also the fact that I asked every single one of them about their Tony Awards, that comes from my growing up and watching the Tony Awards on television, and that to me was the most exciting night of the year. I specifically remember a Tony Awards show ending and being depressed because I was going to have to wait a whole other year for the next Tony Award show. So I think I have, or at least grew up with, a little bit of Tony Award obsession, and it carried into this book.
In the 1970s, the Tony Awards were wonderful because they always taught the history of the stage, and they didn't just have the current musicals, but they had, you know, kind of a retrospective look at musicals every year. And they were always better than the Oscars, too, because... everybody at the Tonys knew their lines. They didn't have to, you know, read cue cards or whatever. And the Tony Awards are still vastly entertaining, but not quite as great as they once were, maybe.
Yes, I agree with you. There used to be a lot more time given over to the entertainment portion. And now, other than just the numbers from the nominated show and perhaps a number from a host, that's it, and the rest of it feels much more like the Oscars, and it's a little bit drier, or even a lot drier. But if you get a hold of some of those old tapes, the 70s and even into the 80s, up until 1986, they were really jam-packed with, you know, bringing back stars like the stars in this book, people like Carol Channing and Ethel Merman and Mary Martin and Robert Preston recreating their numbers on the stage, and it was thrilling.
Yeah, really. Speaking of that, if you could go back in time and get some of those
1959.
That's the year you want to go.
That's the year I would want to be in.
Tell me, what was it in 1959 that you would want to see?
I don't know. 1959 had Merman and Gypsy, and it had Fiorello, which, of course, won the Pulitzer Prize, although it's largely forgotten now. That's always interesting. And it had the original Sound of Music. It was the golden year of the golden age. I would have loved to have seen that.
I bet. So who would you, if you were writing your book in an era in which some of these now deceased performers were still around, who would you put in your book? Ethel Merman, Mary Martin, Gertrude Lawrence?
Sure. Yeah, the book is dedicated, in fact, to Ethel and Mary and Gwen Verdon and Gertrude Lawrence and Pearl Bailey and Dolores Gray, the women I feel that I missed and that I otherwise would have had. Gwen Verdon, I did actually have the privilege of interviewing Gwen Verdon for a periodical years ago, but not for this book. But in fact, one of the things that I love is anybody, especially Ethel Merman, as you go through this book, anybody who worked with Ethel Merman, I ask about Ethel, and I get some great Ethel stories. There is no shortage of amazing Ethel Merman stories on the planet. Every story is incredible.
One of the ones that I loved was, and I can't remember who it is, I think it's Donna McKenzie, who tells you about leaving a show that she's in with Ethel Merman.
Yes, when Donna McKechnie was leaving Call Me Madam, this was a tour, and Donna was very, very young, and it was her last night, and Ethel kept doing things on the stage, and Donna, like, first thought she was having a stroke. She would, you know, she would turn off stage, and she would cross her eyes, she would make phlegm noises from the bottom of her throat, and Donna thought, what the hell is going on? And she only came to find out afterwards that it's a very old vaudeville tradition that on a performers last night, a way of saying, you know, job well done, is to try to crack them up on stage, so that Ethel was in fact trying to crack up Donna McKechnie on stage as a way of saying goodbye, which is a lovely story.
That's great. Ethel Merman, you can still hear her if you're very quiet. You can hear her yelling and screaming.
Yeah, pretty much.
And, you know, Ethel Merman was an actress who, she made a few movies and television appearances, but it was really about Broadway for her, mostly because she never was cast, except, I mean, notably in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, but she didn't ever play her musical role. She wasn't Annie Get Your Gun in the movie. She wasn't in Gypsy.
She did one. She did Call Me Madam on film.
Right.
But she did a version of Anything Goes on film with Frank Sinatra, although
not the
one. As they frequently did with movie musicals, they completely rewrote the plot, so it was very different from what she was performing on stage. But that Call Me Madam performance is pretty good in terms of, you know, seeing what it is she had to offer at the time. It's so rare that happened for anyone. And there are so many that you can name that are just tragic. You talked about Angela Lansbury in Mame, and
terrible movie.
And Charles Channing in Hello, Dolly, which, you know,
another terrible movie. Yeah.
Yes. So when it the couple of times when it actually happened, Gwen Verdon in Damn Yankees, or John Raitt in The Pajama Game, most of the entire cast of 1776 getting, or most of the entire cast of Little Lavender, those movies are really special because it's, as we've said, so rare that somebody got to recreate their role.
How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, also a really great one.
Yeah, almost everybody except for Bonnie Scott, replaced by Michelle Lee, who of course went on to Knots Landing for 85 years.
She was beautiful in that movie, though.
Yes, she was.
And today, you've got a lot of Broadway actresses who are offered TV, get an opportunity to do TV, and as I was saying earlier, maybe millions of more people have seen them on TV or in the movies than will ever see them on the stage, and yet they're drawn back to the stage. All of these women that you interviewed, even Angela Lansbury, think of themselves as primarily stage performers now.
Yes, yeah. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out why, even not having had these interviews. But the stage offers you, even though it's a lot of work, I mean, 8 times a week, and these women describe having to live like nuns, there's something really satisfying about having a live response from an audience, and also having the opportunity every single night to continue to perfect or hone or find or discover within a role, whereas on a film, you shoot it and you move on. So it's not a surprise that they all prefer it, but of course they also like making money and they also like security. So as Laura Benanti says in the book, that TV is her mistress, but theater is her spouse.
We're talking with Eddie Shapiro, and his book is called Nothing Like a Dame, Conversations with the Great Women of Musical Theater. And he's also the author of The Ultimate Gay and Lesbian Guide to the Disney Theme Parks. You know, there's kind of a, I don't know, I think it's a misnomer, but a reputation that the American theater is mostly for gay people. And Neil Patrick Harris always makes a joke about it at the, or gigantic musical number about it at the Tonys. But, you know, I think, and so it wouldn't be surprising if you had a guide, say, a gay guide to Broadway. But what is it about the Disney theme parks that's inherently attractive to gay people?
You know, in that book, in Queens and the Kingdom, I hypothesize about what some of those answers are. I don't claim to know. I just know that it's so, in the same way that, you know, we know that Madonna has a big gay following. Do we know really why? No, we can hypothesize, but we don't really know. I think with the Disney theme parks, there, you know, my theories are that it's certainly bright and colorful, and at the same time, very, very clean. And you know, the gays like it fabulous, but they like it clean. and that there's a thing in Disney that you know, I think a lot of people, a lot of gay people, spent their lives feeling like the underdog and feeling other, and that's true of pretty much all of the Disney animated heroes and heroines. They are all either outcasts or feel like they don't fit in, and then they triumph. So there's that. And I think that for gay people who frequently have spent a lot of their lives feeling either bullied or that they don't fit in or ostracized, both musical theater and Disney offer escape. It's escape into another world, into an immersive world, and that can be quite appealing. So, again, those are hypotheses. Couldn't tell you if anything's real, but those are some theories.
I guess it's just that everybody loves the Magic Kingdoms, and everybody who's ever been to a Broadway show loves that, because it'll change your life if you haven't ever been to one. People should go to New York and go to a Broadway show. It's nothing like it. It's not the same as seeing a show in San Francisco or Los Angeles. It's just completely different.
Yeah, it's true. But it is a peculiar thing that, you know, back to sort of your gay query, everybody loves, or most people love, a Broadway musical, but the gay people get rabid about it. I don't know why, but they do.
maybe they feel more comfortable getting rabid about things.
Maybe. That's an interesting point, too. Maybe they're willing to let their enthusiasm show a little bit more. I don't know.
Well, I'm an enthusiastic fan of this book. It's called Nothing Like a Dame, Conversations with the Great Women of Musical Theater, and the author, my guest, Eddie Shapiro. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
It is so my pleasure, and I should let you know that, of course, the book is available anywhere that books are sold, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all of that, but the book also has its own Facebook page. So you can sort of keep up on events around the book or what the women are doing via that.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Eddie Shapiro. His book, Nothing Like a Dame, Conversations with the Great Women of Musical Theater. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.